Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Today is February 7th, the date of Super Bowl 50, and what better way to celebrate than by talking to Dr. Andrew Johnson, a research associate with the Center for Religion and Civic Culture at the University of Southern California. There, he is part of CRCC's Religious Competition and Creative Innovation Initiative. Wow, that's a lot of C's and R's in that. Anyways, he spent last year as a visiting scholar at the Center for the Study of Religion at Princeton University. Professor Johnson is currently working on a book manuscript and documentary film on Pentecostalism inside prison in Rio de Janeiro, conducted with the assistance of the Pentecostal and Charismatic Research Initiative, which was funded by the Templeton Foundation. He recently published a book chapter on Pentecostals in Brazil in a volume entitled Religious Responses to Violence, edited by Alexander Wilde. We will link to that book at our website, as well as Andrew's biography and documentary film when it is ready to roll. Andrew received his PhD in sociology from the University of Minnesota, Go Gophers, in the fall of 2012, and before doing time in graduate school, he served as a Foreign Service officer in the United States Agency for International Development and also worked at the U.S. embassies in Tegucigalpa, Honduras, and Brasilia, Brazil. Andrew, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. I'm glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, no problem. Hey, let's cut to the chase. I noted in the intro that it's February 7th. This is actually going to be airing a little bit later in February, so people might be a little bit confused, but this is the time we're recording it, and we're about 4 hours away from the Broncos and Panthers game in Super Bowl 50, and so I'm going to just cut to the chase. Who do you like in that game?
Well, I'm actually still recovering from the Vikings loss. I'm a Minnesota fan, and I was at the game. It was 20 below, and it was a heartbreaker. So I'm still not whole after that one, but I think the Panthers are going to win, and the Broncos are going to probably cover the spread. So that's my take on it. Unfortunately, this won't get out until after the game, so people won't be able to make money off this insider bet, but that's my take.
Yeah, this is a reliability check on our social scientists, right? We want to see how good you are in your other stuff by checking your predictions in football. And you were at that game, by the way, which the Seattle Seahawks won, which is my own Seahawks.
Yeah, I was.
Yeah, well, that's good. Anyways, we will let you cheer for the Seahawks next year because they're awesome. Anyways, your research, that's what we're here to talk about. And your research came to my attention in this edited volume that I mentioned in the introduction. And you wrote a chapter called The Politics of Presence, Evangelical Ministry in Brazilian Prisons. And you highlighted what I think is one of the most interesting and ballsy research projects I've ever seen, at least in quite a while. We're going to talk about your methods here in a minute, but it is pretty interesting study. We'll get to, as I said, why it's so courageous in a little bit here. But first of all, tell me how you came upon the topic of studying religion in Brazilian prisons. That just doesn't seem to jump out at people in research topics that they would choose.
Sure. Well, it kind of came out of personal experience, to be honest. I used to coach a basketball team in Minneapolis, and it was kind of a team for at-risk youth or whatever, and I knew these guys from when they were in fifth grade and stuck with them through an open gym until they were 17 or 18. And when they started turning 17, 18, and 19, a lot of them ended up in prison for a short or longer period of time. So visiting them in prison, I became interested in the prison system in the U.S. I really hadn't thought about it before, and so that's how I got interested in that aspect of it. And then I did my master's degree studying kids living on the streets in Sao Paulo, Brazil. And that street kid, kind of the homeless youth population, overlaps the prison population, and I started to hear about these prison churches inside of the prisons outside of Sao Paulo and Rio. So when I went to graduate school to pursue the PhD, that's what I wanted to study, was religion inside of prison.
Okay.
In Brazil.
Now, before, I should also mention too, when I contacted you, and this is a very cool thing, that I saw this topic, I said, man, this is great stuff for the podcast. When I contacted you, you turned out to be a loyal listener to this program.
Yes, I do. I like the format. It's easy, it's accessible, and I hope I do it justice.
All right, very cool. So we're very happy to have you on and talking about this topic as well. But before we get into prison, which is the specific focus of your topic, give us the lay of the land on the Brazilian religious landscape overall. I don't think a lot of people in our listening audience might be aware of what's going on in Brazil. You say, well, it's Portuguese, Latin American country, must be Catholic. Give us a little sense of what is going on there, and in specific relation to some of the areas that you've been studying, the favelas or these poor marginalized areas.
Sure. Well, Brazil is probably the largest Catholic country on earth. So it's, you know, when people think of the Catholic country, in part, they're right. It's maybe 65% Catholic affiliation. That's going down over the last 30 years. But it's also one of the larger Pentecostal countries on earth. And so they say, the best guess is it's 20 to 25% Protestant, the majority of that, maybe 15 to 20% Pentecostal, but that's not evenly distributed throughout the country. And so Pentecostalism does best in the poor, mostly poor urban areas. It's the same place where almost all the inmates come from, these same marginalized favelas. And Pentecostalism kind of does best basically where the state is the weakest. I mean, the state is there in these favelas, it's there very poorly. In health care, in sanitation, in security. And in those areas, the two organizations that kind of rise up are the narco gangs and the Pentecostal church. And so in the poor areas, Pentecostalism is by far the dominant faith. In fact, one of the favelas that I worked in where a lot of ex-inmates lived and were pastoring churches, I think there were 90 Pentecostal churches and one Catholic church. And the third, one of the other religious practices is what they call Macumba, kind of a voodoo, an Afro-Brazilian type religion. And in that neighborhood, the gang that controlled the neighborhood actually prohibited this practice of Macumba, and they closed all the Macumba houses in their area because they saw Macumba as kind of the direct enemy to the Pentecostals. So it gets at this relationship between the gang and the Pentecostals, that there is a mutual respect between them.
Yeah, that is really interesting, and I want to cover that in a second. But you mentioned that there were 90 Pentecostal churches in this neighborhood and one Catholic church. I'm assuming the Catholic church is somewhat big, but these Pentecostal churches, 90 of them, what do they look like? Are these large churches? Are they just storefront churches, Bible study groups? What's the typical Pentecostal church in one of these favelas look like?
I mean, they range, but most of them are small to medium churches. I mean, in Pentecostalism, you need enough people to call you pastor to be a pastor. You don't have to go through a series of formal hoops or formal education. And so a lot of them are storefront churches with, you know, 30 to 50 white plastic chairs kind of set up. And then if they do well, they might, you know, move into a larger place or buy a place instead of renting. So most of them are, you know, 50 to 150 member churches. And then also there are some larger churches. There are some mega churches and things like that. Not as many in these particular neighborhoods, but in Rio there are Pentecostal mega churches as well. But most of the ones that I studied are in the small to medium range.
And who's going to these churches? Are these churches filled with little old ladies, or are they filled with young kids? Who do you see in these churches?
Well, you know, I would say the majority, it depends on. I was surprised at how many, you know, if you look at the statistics, you know, women are more likely to go to church than men, but there are a lot of men and a lot of young men in these churches as well. And the ones that I was drawn to was the ones where ex-inmates were attending. So I didn't get that's kind of the sample that I saw. But mostly it's people who can walk to these places. I mean, these places really do, they don't have, many of the places I study don't have parking lots, and that when service starts, people start, strolling in with their Bibles under their arms, you know, walking from their house to the church, and people know each other, and so they know the pastor usually lives close, and so they really do have that feel for for the neighborhood.
Yeah, so it'd be people from, you know, a couple square blocks around it, that would be, and which explains why you get about 90 of these churches in some of these places. Seems pretty densely packed, yeah.
I was actually surprised it could all, in certain places there are so many Pentecostal churches around, it's surprising they can all stay afloat, but they're there.
Yeah, that's another question I have, is that who are the pastors that do this? We oftentimes, here in the United States, we think of pastors, they have a full-time job, and so they're at the job 5 days a week, usually from Wednesday through Sunday, or Tuesday through Sunday, or something like that, and they get their income through the donations that come in. Some smaller churches have pastors that do some other kind of job on the side, maybe sell insurance or things like that. Who are the pastors in these places, especially if they're relatively small and in poor neighborhoods? I can't imagine they're making their income off of the donations being given.
Right. I mean, some of the pastors I met, they're painters during the day, and they have, you know, full-time jobs, and they also have service 4 times a week, you know, with Monday, Wednesday, Fridays, and something on Sunday, and so their schedules are packed. Some of the bigger churches, the donations and tithes are enough to keep them going, and of course, you know, some of the mega churches, some of the pastors are some of the wealthiest people in Brazil. The churches that I studied were, you know, kind of the small and medium ones. Some pastors were able to make it just on the tithes and offerings alone. Others had other sources of income, mostly in the trades, construction, things like that.
Now, one of the things you mentioned before in relation to Macumba were these drug gangs, and the drug gangs chased off the Macumba churches or practices in the neighborhoods that you had been visiting. And that's really kind of interesting. They did this for the Pentecostal churches, thinking that they're a competitor to the Pentecostal churches, which you listen to that, you go, wait a minute, these drug gangs are helping out the Pentecostal churches? Your chapter, it really kind of gets into this relationship between gangs and these Pentecostal churches in the favelas, which we will find out carries on into prison. What's going on there?
Well, there's a surprising amount of, I shouldn't say surprising, but given their stated goals, I mean, the gang is all about money, sex, and power. I mean, it's in their music, it's in their mission statement, if you will. But there is this respect that the two institutions have for each other. One is the Pentecostals don't talk about the gangs like the rest of the city does. I mean, the gang members, specifically prisoners, are kind of the most hated people in Rio. They're the ones who cause all the violence. One thing too is that the city really tolerates very, very high levels of violence in the city, as long as it's kind of isolated in these favelas, specifically with gang members. So, for example, in the United States right now, one thing that people are talking about is the death caused by police officers, and whether they're police brutality or self-defense. It seems like there are around 400 police killings per year in the U.S. In Rio, which is a city about the size of Chicago, there are over 1,000 police killings every single year. And so in Rio, there are, you know, 2.5 times more police killings in one city than the entire United States. And this really hasn't drawn a reaction from the civil society. And so in the book, and I kind of talk about, these are the killable people, because they can kind of be killed without a reaction from the city. So the Pentecostals come with a very different message. I mean, they come with this message that they talk to the gang members and they say, you know, you can be redeemed, your life has value. And when you walk into some of these gang-controlled neighborhoods, I mean, I'll explain one neighborhood that I knew quite well. And so you walk in, and there's kind of a cement wall with a hole in it, and in front of the hole are two teenagers holding AR-15s or AK-47s, you know, shirtless guys smoking weed, and they're the ones who let in every single, they watch every single person coming in or coming out. And so you pass them, and there's kind of a picnic table that's got four cardboard boxes on it, two of different packets of powdered cocaine and two of different sizes of marijuana. And behind that table, there are a couple other guys with enormous automatic weapons, and another guy with a wad of cash as big as a softball in his hand. And there's kind of 15 or 20 people lining up by the table and walk up to the table. And so everything, the drug trade really takes place openly like that. And in order to have that sort of a drug trade, you got to control the whole neighborhood. So the police, the fire trucks, the ambulances, they can't enter there. They block off the exits. And so this is kind of the context of how of the gang, and then the Pentecostals are right in the middle of that. And so in that same neighborhood, I walked in there with our pastor one time, and he wanted to talk to the person, the gang leader in charge of the neighborhood, and he wanted to thank him because their gang stopped selling crack in that area, because crack is kind of seen as an especially destructive drug. So he put the message through that he wanted to see the leader, and we waited 15 or 20 minutes, and the leader came down, and he has a kind of a duffel bag full of cash on his arm, and he's with kind of two bodyguards. And all these guys are basically dripping in gold. I mean, they have Rolex watches and gold rings that cover three or four fingers and gold necklaces and gold chains, and they're heavily armed. But when the pastor comes, you know, the pastor said, "I want to thank you for stop selling crack in this area. God is pleased by this. And, you know, let's work together so we can end selling the rest of this." And the rest of this stuff, and he kind of pointed to the drug table over there. And when he said, "Can I pray for you?" You know, even though these guys are have automatic weapons draped over their arm, they bow their heads, and the pastor puts his hands on them, and he prays for them. And so they're, and he prays that God watches over them, and that God, you know, works in their life. And it's a very different message, and it's something that the gang members respect. They might not buy into all of the theological nuance of the Pentecostalism, but they're also not atheists, and they think that the Pentecostals are tapping into something that's there. They think there's a power out there, and that they don't want to go up against that power.
Wow. Yeah, you talk too in the chapter about how when a pastor walks in, the gang members basically try to straighten up the community a little bit, you know, make it a little bit more church-like.
Yeah, when they do street revival services and things like that, and so kind of this open air drug market that I described. It's a portable drug market. It's just a couple of coffee tables and a few boxes of cocaine, so you can move that pretty easily. And so, if the church would want to do a revival service or some sort of a witness, you know, the gang will actually help them bring in the speakers and help them set up, and they'll move their drug distribution points to different parts of the city so that people don't have to pass that as they're going to the service. So there is that. It is kind of a strange thing to think of, that because in my mind, the Pentecostals would be a big competition for the gang, because if you join the Pentecostals, you leave your gang affiliation and things like that. But that's not how it works. And I just saw kind of this cooperation over and over again.
Yeah, that is absolutely fascinating, and that actually blends into the research that you do in the prison environment too. Which makes your chapters one of the most fascinating book chapters and dissertation projects I've read in quite a long time. Let's go ahead and walk into the prison now and tell us the story about the relationship between religion and specifically Pentecostalism in this prison environment, which is basically locked down, but it's still a very violent place. This is not a place, you know, Brazilian prison, you don't want to go there. Even American prisons are pretty tough. Brazilian prisons, I can imagine, are pretty...
Well, mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's these prisons kind of reflect the other inequalities or other relationships in the city. And so, you know, I said Pentecostalism is strong where the state is weak. Well, the state's very weak inside of these prisons. One of the jails that I spent a lot of time at, there was, 800 inmates in there, and at night there was one police officer on duty, and he wouldn't open the door for anything. So they're kind of there by themselves, they don't have the same sort of technology and monitoring or even assigning cells. And so the inmates, like in the favelas, organize around the gang, which is the most powerful organization inside of prison, and also the Pentecostal church. And so there's, in every jail and prison, there's a prison church that's run by the inmates. There's an inmate pastor, inmate worship team, inmate secretary, And in most of these places, they have their own cell. They call it the brother cells. And so that's kind of the engine of this Pentecostalism inside of prison. And you're saying just about the living conditions. I was just so shocked when I first got in there because I hadn't seen anything like that. These cells were built for 15 guys, and even at 15, it's pretty crowded in there, but they had 70 people in there.
Right.
So at night, the small beds, you had two people sleeping on there head to toe. They would sleep head to toe throughout the whole floor area, and there still wasn't enough room. So some men would try to tie themselves to the bars and sleep with a T-shirt and sleep standing up, and then they would just have to take turns. And it's hot. I mean, the air feels different. It's thick. You start sweating instantly. And it's a really intense experience.
Now, you did something that is really amazing. And I think few researchers would have the courage to do this kind of thing, because not only did you visit the prison over 40 times, and that's an experience unto itself, but you actually lived in one of these prisons as an inmate for about 2 weeks. Tell us about that.
I did. Well, it was when I was starting things out. I mean, I knew that I was coming at this from a long ways away. I was familiar with Brazil. I speak Portuguese. But, a Brazilian prison is a very different place from the suburban Minneapolis home where I grew up in. And so I didn't want to come in, questions blazing, basically. I wanted to figure out exactly what was going on there. And to be honest, the way I got the idea of living in a prison is I took a tour of Louisiana State Penitentiary, Angola, and they have an inmate seminary there. So I wanted to talk to one of the inmates about, religion inside a prison. And the guards brought him out, and I was asking him questions. And he was answering my questions, but as we were talking, the guard was right over my shoulder. And so I could see the inmate make eye contact with the guard as we were talking back and forth. And it hit me that this isn't the way to do this. I have to get to a place where, one, I can have conversations and ask questions where the guard isn't looking over my shoulder. And then I really wanted to get to know these guys a little bit before I just start, peppering them with questions. So that's what kind of gave me the idea that, well, if I could find a prison that I feel safe in and things like that, I could just go through the daily rhythms as if I were an inmate. And so the prison that I was at was in a different state and in better, there weren't 80 guys in my cell, there were four, but there were 80 guys in my cell block, and it was a maximum security prison. And I, ate the same food and used the same bathrooms and kind of did the daily routines as if I were an inmate. And I could have left, but by doing that, I was able to, I guess, get a little better sense of what it actually, some of the emotional weight of being in prison. I remember I had been there for 3 or 4 days, and I realized that, man, every day kind of looks the same in here. You kind of know what the next day is going to bring. And the guy below me, who was in prison for bringing a truckload of cocaine from Paraguay, he snored louder than anybody I had met before. And I was awake, and it hit me that night. I thought, what if I had to do 10 years in this place, like this guy below me? And it was something about that, when I was asking myself that question, it didn't seem as abstract, because it would be, what if I had to do 10 years on this bunk bed with these guys in this cell with this sort of daily rhythm? And it was just almost too much to handle, because I had all these hopes and dreams and plans in the next 10 years. And if all those were wiped away, put on that the addition of the pain and suffering for my family, the victims, if I was there for a violent crime or something like that. And so things like that allowed me to get it a little better. I mean, I understand why the breakfast line in the morning is not a happy place, because people are waking up, in the same place again. So the other thing I learned from there is that, at least in Brazilian prison subculture, there's a lot of respect and reverence for volunteers, specifically religiously affiliated volunteers, and that they go out of their way to show respect. And that's what really kind of paved the way for the rest of my studies, that I was treated very, very well by these guys. They treated me with hospitality, and they knew what I was doing, and they were glad to have me there. So
yeah, that's really interesting. I have to ask some just basic questions here, questions you don't really cover in the chapter that I read. How did you ever get this past the internal review board, or sometimes it's called the human subjects board, that I'm going to insert myself in prison for a couple weeks, or even the folks with the, you know, the Pentecostal Research Initiative, you tell them, I'm going to go spend a couple weeks in prison, and then get a little froggy saying, well, what if this guy gets beaten up and killed or something? That's not going to be really good for the, you know, folks funding this.
Right, right. Well, it took some paperwork. It took some paperwork, and I had to get permission from the from Brazil, basically. And so they knew what I was doing. So it took a little while, and I had, you know, because inmates are vulnerable, so I've got to go through a few more steps and things like that. But, you know, it went. And then I also just had to explain to the inmates themselves. When I first got in there, they didn't know exactly why I was there. And so I had to kind of go through and explain, you know, what I was planning on doing. And the fact that I was there just to say, I want to see what you guys are doing in here. I wasn't there to teach or preach or any part of a program or anything like that. And so that really helped me. They were glad. A lot of the guys were proud of what they were, who they had become, and what they were doing in there. And they were glad that someone was there. So and it also just took a lot of time. I went into graduate school knowing this is what I wanted to study. So I had basically three, as I was doing my classes, I had 3 years to get all the pieces of the puzzle in place, and it worked out.
What did your graduate advisor say, your dissertation mentor? I mean, if somebody came to me and says, I want to spend a couple of weeks in a prison in Brazil, are you okay with that? I'd go, whoa, no. I would get really nervous. Or what about your family, too? I mean, didn't your family say, well, you know, we had other plans for you, son?
Yeah, I to be honest, I gave my family kind of the details after I was finished. And my advisor was good, but it wasn't like I've been kind of leading up to this for a few years, so it wasn't a complete surprise. And they were supportive, and my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, who was in Brazil, was concerned. I will say that much, but it worked out.
So what about that first day that you're about to do this? So you're set up to say, I've done all the paperwork and I'm about ready to go in. What was that first day like? Did you have to pause and say, whoa, what am I doing here?
You know, that's what I did. It all sounded great in theory. I had the permission and everything was ready to go. And I got off the bus in the town where the prison was at, and I remember just there was a kind of a main city park, and I sat on this picnic bench, and I was thinking to myself, what am I doing? What have I gotten myself into? This could go very wrong here. And I was supposed to be there at noon, and I remember at, I think, 12:35 or 12:40, I was still sitting on that bench and kind of contemplating. And I just had to take a couple breaths and just say, hey, this is what I signed up for. And once I got in, I was fine. I mean, they gave me a pillow and a blanket and said, you know, we'll see you in a couple of weeks. And it worked out. But it was just a matter of kind of going up to the prison, knocking on the door and saying, I'm here. Mm-hmm. And then once I got in, it was within the first 5 or 10 minutes, word got out of exactly who I was, what I was there doing there. And like I said, I was treated well. I got a number of the men said, hey, we're glad you're here. You don't have to worry about things. You'll be safe. And so that was reassuring.
Yeah, that was neat. I was going to ask you how people reacted to you, because you don't look Brazilian. You look very Minnesota, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, people are, you know, this guy walks in like, who is he? And he's I'm a sociologist. What's you're arresting sociologists now? Good, probably some of them said. I don't know. But yeah, it word gets around. So they're somewhat protecting you. And did anything over the course of the few weeks that you were in there change? I mean, your feeling of what it was like the first day versus, say, day 14 or so?
Yeah, you know, the first couple days, especially that first night, I was like, all right, how do I do this? I mean, what do I do? I mean, I had one shelf, and so I put my toothbrush and things like that on there, and I had a few change of clothes. So I folded that up. I made my bed exactly like the rest of the people. They put their sheets in a certain way, so I did that. And then I think, okay, what now? And there was a small concrete court where they play soccer, and I'm not a soccer guy myself, but I kind of wandered in there, and I thought the first thing I thought is there's no way I'm playing this. I'm gonna break my nose, or it's a rough game. And then someone called over and said, "Hey, Gringo, you got the next game." And so I grabbed my shorts and shoes and started playing. And it was actually things like playing soccer with these guys over the week that really kind of tore down some of those, or helped to dissolve some of those initial barriers. Because there's something about that soccer where you're on the same team with these, we played 4-on-4, and where we could talk or we could do something. It was actually good that I was not as good as they were, that we could do something they were better than me at, and I kind of needed a little help and a little guidance. And I remember, I think it was 4 or 5 days in, I was going for a ball, and a guy kind of shoved me into the wall, and I shoved him back, and we went at it a little. It was friendly, and that was when I kind of sunk in that, hey, they're taking off the kid gloves. I mean, they're treating me like they kind of do each other to a certain extent. And so, and I was involved in a game that went too late one time, and we were late for dinner and kind of got in trouble, and so I was part of that. And anyway, as the time went on, the novelty wore off, and I became a little more of I was never, just one of the guys, but, you're there for a long time, and so you have a lot of conversations, and there's a lot of downtime. And so that was the part that I thought that was really valuable for me.
Yeah, I don't want to spend too much time on just your personal experience, because I want to get to your research findings. But there's one other question I have, is that you talked about the first day going in and how you sat on the park bench taking a couple deep breaths going, okay, I'm going to do this. What about when you left? I mean, was it a different experience? Did you go back to the same park bench and just sit down and said, whew, okay, I did that?
I do remember that, because it was really humbling to be, I wanted to say thank you. And I still keep in touch with some of these guys, but it was really, really humbling to have been, accepted like that, and to have, to have people with almost nothing, share part of their, grilled cheese sandwich that they make at night, or just kind of open up their lives to you, or just to take you in. And, so I was, really, really, really grateful. And then also, I don't know if I could do it if I had to do as much time, or I was in that same situation. I don't know what, if I would crack or what, but I walked out of there. It was a humbling experience.
Yeah. So, for those you graduate students out there or contemplating graduate school, I mean, you got to talk to Andrew here, because I mean, this is methodology to the extreme. And this is, again, I have to say, this is one of the most courageous projects I've ever read about. So, great for you. So let's start talking about some of your findings now, and talking both about the stuff that you found in prison and then also more generally in your studies. And I want to roll back a little bit here to the first paragraph or two in your book chapter called The Politics of Presence. You start with this really interesting story that shocked me a little bit about the relationship between Pentecostalism and prisoners in this point in time. It deals with a pastor, Marcos Perjeda, I think is his name, and his staff helping to end a prisoner riot and hostage crisis. Tell me about that and how this fits into the broader themes of what you're studying.
Well, yeah, so this has happened in a number of cases, but this particular pastor is known for this. I think he's been involved in 12 or 13 prison riot mediations, and, things get tough. In this case, they were, throwing decapitated heads of hostages over the wall to get people's attention, which works. And so before they sent in the SWAT team, which who knows how many they would have killed. I mean, there's a history in Brazil when the police arrived, there was a massacre in the Sao Paulo prison that they killed dozens and dozens and dozens of inmates in a prison riot. I think it was 190 or something like that. I forget the number. So these pastors sometimes will step into these situations of crisis. And they're able to do that because, one, is that they're not chaplains, or they're not state employees. And so they're able to kind of operate in that middle ground where they have the trust and respect of the inmates, but they're also, you know, the prison administration knows that they're useful as well, because they're not going to be able to quiet these rebellions or solve these rebellions for themselves. So they operate in a very unique space. And they also, frankly, they side on the side of the inmates. The inmates know that these guys are trying to do what's best for us. Or that's what they think, at least. And so you see that on the large scale in the very visible in the prison riots, but I also saw it in smaller instances. I saw an inmate who was thrown in jail for killing a police officer. A group of kind of off-duty cops showed up at a strange time and wanted to take him away, and it was during a service inside of prison, and a pastor who was there kind of stepped in, talked to the warden, and said, you know, in the name of Jesus, don't take this guy, because he knew they were going to take him and kill him. And so that's on the personal level, too. These will sometimes stand up for the inmates' safety.
Yeah, those stories were really gripping, and I do want to point people back to your writings on this, and also the documentary, which we'll talk to in a little bit, because it's something that you wouldn't expect, but then when you think through this, you're like, oh yeah, this makes a lot of sense. The prisoners are as scared as the police as anybody, even when they're in the prison, they know that they're going to get killed, and it's these pastors, these Pentecostal ministers, or other folks that come in that can be on their side and basically prevent them from being killed.
Absolutely, and that's I think one of the reasons why Pentecostalism has kind of flourished in Brazil. Is there's all the theological aspects of it, certainly. I don't mean to just push that aside, but also there's a lot of very practical aspects of it that these guys garner respect. So they do things like, for example, when you're thrown into prison, you don't always get your first phone call. And so I met a lot of guys in the jail, especially, who said, "Hey, I've been in here for a month and a half, and my family doesn't know where I am. Can you call my mother or my aunt or whoever?" And so the pastors who were in there almost every single day would do things like that, or they would visit families who were, you know, with their husband or boyfriend in prison, bring them food or bring them rice and beans to see how they're doing. And so some of these basic service or social service type things also really was an integral part of why the inmates treated visiting pastors with such reverence.
Yeah, so go ahead and discuss the role of the pastor here. You talk about them, you know, being able to give them phone calls and bringing in some beans and rice or something like that. How does religion manifest itself in this prison, both what you saw directly and then what you have heard from other, you know, instances that you've been studying as well?
Well, I mean, the main kind of the heart and soul of the religion in prison is all these Pentecostal prison churches that are run by the inmates. And so they're the ones who, and you know, a lot of people, when you're thrown into prison, you're scared, you're wondering, you know, how you got there, and a lot of times, you know, sorry for what's maybe a mistake you've made and things like that. And you're making good with God makes a lot of sense at that point. Also, if you're someone wants to attack you, the inmates are hands off. They don't touch the people who are part of the prison church. And so for some people, maybe it's a refuge or it's a way of safety, especially for anyone who is convicted of some sort of a sexual crime. Those guys don't last long in prison. And so there's that aspect, because the gang says, if you're part of the brother's cells, we don't touch you. But there's this constant theme of authenticity that kind of goes, who's serious about it, or who's just, what they say, hiding behind the Bible. And so, really, your stated religious affiliation isn't worth a lot in prison. I mean, they hear people, you know, all the time who say, "I'm this or I'm that." But the unique thing about prison is that people can watch how you act 24 hours a day. And so, if you go into prison and you make a public conversion, that's fine, but then your daily life has to really follow that conversion. So there's no smoking, no drinking, no drugs. There's a whole list of do's and don'ts the Pentecostal inmates have. And as long as your actions back up your, you know, what you say, you're fine, and the gang says, "We won't touch you." And that idea of just looking at what people do is kind of what led my research, because once again, this idea of authenticity, it's above my pay grade whether the inmates are, you know, really believe what they say they do. In fact, I didn't want to get into that too much, but what I could do is look how they act, and look what they do daily. And so they do things like, you know, collective fasting campaigns, and they take offerings, and they will buy a bus ticket for someone's mother to come visit them that doesn't have the money. And so there's a whole bunch of religious practices they could do that I could observe and stick with that.
Now, how do these churches get organized? Who decides who becomes the pastor? I'm sure that this is not a trained seminarian who's been going to theological school for the last 7 years. And I know a lot of Pentecostal ministers, especially in Brazil, kind of learn on the job and then move on to your different church. But, you know, these guys, they were doing something different on the outside, and all of a sudden they're thrown in here. How does somebody get to become a pastor?
Well, that's a great question. And they vote. They vote among themselves who's going to be pastor and who's going to be secretary and who's going to be worship leader. And so your daily practice makes all the difference. And so another thing they do to make sure these churches keep running is a secretary position, for example. They'll have a secretary, an assistant secretary, and a secretary in training. So if the secretary is transferred or released from prison, the assistant will bump up to the secretary, the trainee will come to the assistant, and they'll vote again. And so these churches can have continuation over decades, especially in the prisons that have a more stable population because of that system. And so they're able to kind of have that institutional weight inside a prison. And then they're able to buy their instruments and buy a pulpit. And a lot of them, one of the churches had their own T-shirts made up, so you knew who was part of the church. And so that's how they're able to do it. You're right. They're not coming out of seminary. And I think one of the reasons that this faith is so successful in prison is because it empowers people that don't necessarily have the right degrees or credentials or even reputations that other people might have. And so because of the situation and their ability to watch how someone behaves all day, every day, people are able to show, and they say, hey, God's doing a change in my life, or God has done something in my life. There's a lot of evidence that would back that up.
Yeah, I can see that Pentecostalism is really one of these faiths where you get a lot of passion from within, God changing your life, and you exhibit that outwards. And those are the folks that get tapped for being the pastor or this position of secretary. I'm interested in this because you mentioned this in the chapter two, and now that I think about it, what does the secretary do? I understand the role of the pastor. I can understand the role of the music leader or the, you know, other pastor, you know, vice pastor who helps with worship services. But what does the secretary do?
Well, yeah, in the large prison where there was a couple hundred people in the church. So, for example, the first time I was there, I walked in and he had me sign a guest book, and the guest book was old. The pages were weathered and things like that, and it was filled with dozens and dozens and dozens of signatures of other people coming in. This is mostly religious volunteers from churches who have come in, and so they take your name, your address, and your home church. And then I was sitting down, and maybe 45 minutes into the sermon, I was passed an intricately folded note that was on the prison church's stationery. That was a welcome letter saying, we're very glad you're here today. We want to make sure, you know, welcome and visit you again. And it was signed by the secretary and the pastor. And so he took care of the welcoming visitors, recording who was coming, and then also things like keeping track of the money, because they would take offerings after every service as well. And so keeping the money. And then also with purchases and things like that. They had bought a silver, or maybe it was plated, whatever, communion tray, and they had a nice wooden pulpit there and some musical instruments as well that they had all purchased with tithes from the inmates.
this is really fascinating to me because I haven't spent any time in prison and I haven't even visited. So my image of prison is that, well, you go into a cell and you get let out for meals and there's some time in the yard to play soccer or whatever it might be. But to, you know, be making t-shirts and to be having instruments and buying a pulpit, you must have a specific room that is dedicated to all this stuff. I mean, the organization here is pretty complex, more complex than I think most people would think of. Describe how one of these churches operates. Do they have their own room or special, equipment?
Yeah, well, In the larger prison, they have their own room, and so they're able to kind of organize around their own room with a little baptismal pool and things like that. But also, the guards in most of these places don't go behind prison the cell blocks. I mean, they're scared for their lives. So when you think of the U.S. context, where there's cameras all over the place and there's a tremendous amount of employees working at the facility, It's different in Brazil, where they kind of guard the perimeter, and then, you know, what happens inside. So that's one of the main differences. And then, what they used to do is, this is just kind of changed over the last few years, is that the Pentecostals inside of prison would wear suits and ties inside of prison. And so you had to figure out a way for your family to get you a suit and tie. And so you can imagine most of these guys wore shorts and flip-flops and a T-shirt, but then there was this one group of inmates who had their, you know, Pentecostal uniform on as well. So it's I think the prisons are more, the walls are a little more porous than they are in the U.S. And then also there's a little more of a different idea of what it means to monitor kind of the daily lives of the inmates. So I talked to one of the wardens. He says, yeah, I put the Pentecostals on this end because this is the end that's most susceptible to escape. And so since I know they're not going to escape, I put them down there and let them do their thing down there. So it's just a different way of doing prison.
So from your sense of this, do you, and again, I don't want to dive into the authenticity and you into reading people's minds, whether their faith is true or not, but from the outside, can you see that this is really impacting some people's lives? Do they spend some time in there, get involved in one of these Pentecostal churches, and then go back out on the outside and continue with religious services or try to rehabilitate kids in a neighborhood or something?
Yeah, I mean, from what I've seen, I would say absolutely. And I think one of the takeaways from this project is I kind of want to detach the religious practice and recidivism. I mean, when people, mostly sociologists and criminologists, study faith-based programming in the U.S., they always talk about, well, inmates who leave are much less likely to come back. And a couple reasons I want to do that. One is because I think looking at their faith alone is worthy of study. But then also, you know, the criminal justice system comes down on different segments of society in different ways. And I don't want to hold up the Brazilian criminal justice system of the U.S. as kind of the judge of authenticity. And I think you can have authentic faith, come out of prison, you mess up, and go back to prison and still not have been faking it. Another thing is that I think the inmate has kind of a unique perspective on faith. Instead of looking at inmates as someone who needs to be fixed or rehabilitated, you know, if you've lost all your family, your freedom, your hopes for the future, and your dignity, and your reputation, and everything else has been stripped away, and all you have is your faith, well, you hold on to that with an intensity that is pretty hard to replicate outside of prison. So I really wanted to capture that and say that maybe these guys have a perspective on this that's hard to get on the outside. I met a lot of inmates, ex-inmates, who said the churches on the outside aren't nearly as serious as we were on the inside. On the inside, I mean, we would do everything together. If one person goes, everyone goes. So it's kind of this intentional living community where it's a very powerful experience, and some of the disappointments almost coming out of prison were to find a church that had the same sort of intensity as their prison church did. And when you start going to these small storefront Pentecostal churches in the favelas of Rio, there are a lot of people there who have spent time in prison. It wasn't hard to find ex-inmates by going to these churches, and some were pastors. And so I don't have the data to say, you know, you're more or less, you're 70% more likely to not come back to prison if you were in the Pentecostal church. But certainly, just by visiting these churches, I met dozens and dozens of men who were in prison, had a religious experience, and have maintained that religious affiliation after being released.
Yeah, that's a really good point about just the intensity, because you're in a very existential living condition in these prisons. And I mean, it's just a different life. And again, as a sociologist who goes in and, you know, really soaks yourself into this environment, I mean, it's amazing. Good stuff you got here. Let me ask you about this. We oftentimes think about how religion impacts prison life. But one of the things that you discuss in your chapter as well is how prison life affects some of the pastors, and specifically some of the pastors that come in from the outside or who are in these favelas who are really ministering. They start out dealing with some of these people who are really tough. It's a violent situation, and you're going to have to imagine there's going to be some kind of feedback for these folks. And one of the folks that we had talked about earlier, this hostage negotiator, Pastor Prajeda, he ended up getting arrested for drug laundering or money laundering and drugs as well. I mean, how does the relationship flow backwards from this violent life to the pastors?
Well, that's a great question. I did see some of that. There were, especially with this Pastor Prajeda, that was the one place where I felt like my life may have been, or that I could have been in some danger, because I had the sense that he probably was involved in some other things on the side. I mean, he had all the, you know, dozens of imported luxury cars in his church that was in a very poor neighborhood, and just kind of had a certain way about him that sent off a couple red flags. On the other hand, his doors were wide open for people coming out of prison or people whose lives were at risk by gang members. And so I met a lot of people whose, I think, lives were saved by his ministry. But, and I don't know the whole progression of things, but he was in a very unique spot that's very, very close to the gang and the drug trade, and literally hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars that are going back and forth. And you can see how that's a temptation. And then the kind of the power that he had in the neighborhood, too, I think changes people, including pastors. So that same spot that enables them to, you know, stop violence and to negotiate, also, for some, is, you know, it's a very tight line and can lead into, you know, doing some criminal activity yourself.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, it's a rough and tumble life just living in these places and trying to minister too. And you can imagine the impact going mm-hmm. both ways. I want to finish off here in the last 10 minutes or so that we have, talking about another thing that is very interesting. Again, you're incredibly innovative for going and living in a prison, just immersing yourself in this environment, but you're also really innovative in how you're getting your research findings out. You know, most people, we write book chapters, we write articles, we write books, publish. That's the thing that's going on. But you're making a documentary film, and I just think that is ingenious, because over the past decade, two decades, the lowering of the cost associated with video and audio recording has really made this accessible to scholars, but we have not been taking advantage of that technology the way that we should have. So tell me about this film. How did you decide to do something like this? Did you have some learning process in it? What do you think about this kind of method of getting your research findings out for the future?
I love it. It's been a huge learning curve for me. But basically, the idea came, I thought I should get something, a 5 to 7 minute clip on, you know, I could put on YouTube, or I don't know what it was. But the idea was that I can't describe through my writing the intensity of the religious practice and just of the conditions of the jail. Like, I can say there's 70 guys crammed into a cell, but when you actually see 70 guys in there, it's kind of, it's something different about that. And the other was that I realized that nobody I was talking to down there would ever read an article in a peer-reviewed journal, and probably not the book either. I mean, who knows? I'm hopefully write that as in a way that's accessible as possible. But I wanted to do something that I could show back in Brazil, or that I could show in churches or in prisons or in other places. And so I started talking with a filmmaker. His name's Ryan Patch, and he's Storytellers Inc. is his company. And so I said, hey, how do you do this? And another friend of mine had come down. He rented a camera, and so we started filming interviews. And I was kind of, in my mind, I was kind of following the structure of my dissertation. And so I was just filming all these interviews, not really sure what was going to happen. So when I started working with a filmmaker, he said, well, one thing he said, like, where's your B-roll? And I said, what's that? And so we had a lot of holes, you know, of things. But he also said, we need characters. He said, your academic arguments or things like that aren't that compelling in film. And I kind of fought back a little bit. I said, no, it should be like this. And he said, we want people to feel something when they watch a film. And so I really had to let go of some of the ways that I had thought about presenting my ideas and presenting my arguments. And it's been a really useful process. And so working with somebody else from a different discipline, I could have never done this myself. I don't even know how to turn the camera on. But I do, so the two of us working together, I think, was great. And we've showed it all over the place. We showed it at, I think, a dozen film festivals and 15 to 20 universities and some churches and some other kind of community places. And we're going to go to Brazil too, and all the inmates who are the guys who are out who have all seen the film, and it's easy to do a Portuguese version. And so it's really, you know, the thing's 55 minutes long. You can show it in a class, but you can just use it in different places. And so it's been difficult because it, you know, not everyone thinks it's this is real academic work, but I think it opens up a lot of doors and to get things out there and to audiences that wouldn't read the traditional academic output.
No, I'm saying amen to you, brother, on this one, because I think it is a really good technology. Yeah, you don't get, you know, high impact factor for publishing in the American Sociological Review. But, you know, again, as you say, it opens lots of doors. A lot of people are going to get to see this. And as you say, you showed this around in different places. I mean, just from your vantage point as a scholar, right? And we know what the scholar life is like. You go to conferences, you present a paper, people say really smart things to you. But you're in this environment, you show this film. What, how do you feel when you're showing this and the reaction you get from the audience? Is it much different than the academic experience?
For me, especially initially, I was just really nervous because you see yourself up there. And it's different, I guess, because it's a finished product, and you put it out there, you can answer questions and things like that. But I don't know. I think this is for this particular project, it was the right thing to do. And, you know, whether people think it's, you know, counts as academic research or not, I guess that's not my call. I think it is. I think this thing makes sense. And so that was kind of my reasoning. And, you know, what other either departments or tenure committees or things like that, that's kind of out of my control.
Well, I will make it my call. I say this is academic research and it should count, and that we should be doing more of this as scholars. So yay verily for you. So very cool.
All right, thank you.
And we'll link people to this as so that they can see it as well, because I think it's just a great way of showcasing what you are learning in a different way, in a different manner, to a different audience. So I can't speak highly enough of your efforts here, both living in the prison and then taking it in different distribution channels. And speaking of learning, this is my kind of final question that I give to all my guests, or many of my guests, is what did you learn from this process? I mean, you learn a lot of things in an academic thing. You learn these facts, and it verifies your theories and stuff. But I'm talking about the learning that changes you somehow. Did you go into this project thinking some things and then you changed your mind along the way? Did you find some surprises? Did this alter your outlook on life in general? What say you on that?
Well, I went in just religion. I didn't realize how strong Pentecostalism was. And frankly, I didn't know a lot of Pentecostalism. I hadn't been to a lot of Pentecostal churches or really seen much. And so that was one surprise, just how vibrant that this particular slice of Christianity is in these places. What really stuck with me, I guess, is this idea of dignity. I mentioned before at the how violence in a lot of these neighborhoods are, and really the slice of Rio that's treated as second-class citizens, and then prisoners are somewhere below that. And yet, so you have all the cards stacked against these guys, and a lot of them, most of them, have done things that have hurt other people's lives. I mean, so these guys aren't just, purely victims of their surroundings. But the idea to live a moral and dignified life in spite of it all, and to say, yeah, I know people on the outside, I heard this a lot of times, even from the gang leaders, say, people on the outside think we're animals in here. We're raping and killing each other. But as you can see, that's not what it's like. And so the idea of, in spite of really difficult circumstances, saying this is the way I'm going to live my life, I think was really powerful. And taught me a lot about my own faith. And I think just the importance of religion inside a prison, that it's something beyond just, well, does it make them less likely to commit a crime in the future or not? And I think that sometime in the midst of really difficult circumstances, those on the outside looking in can catch something about what it means to live your faith day to day that you can't catch on the street. And so that's kind of what I took away from it.
Some very powerful lessons and a very powerful study. And I want to recommend as many people to pick up your book when it eventually comes out, but check out the documentary and the other aspects of your research. We'll make sure that we link to everything and folks check that out. My guest today has been Andrew Johnson. Andrew, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.